From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
To promote peace and stability in the broader Middle East, the United States will work with our friends in the region to fight the common threat of terror while we encourage a higher standard of freedom.
Today, we look at the State of the Union Address and we'll speak with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies.
Bush's speech used all of his inauguration rhetoric about freedom and liberty, but he said nothing about ending the real challenges to freedom and liberty, particularly in the Middle East, the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Then, Social Security.
As we fix Social Security, we also have the responsibility to make the system a better deal for younger workers. And the best way to reach that goal is through voluntary personal retirement accounts.
First, it was weapons of mass destruction. Now it's the bankruptcy of Social Security. Today, a debate. Paul Krugman of the New York Times versus Eric Engen of the American Enterprise Institute. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. During his State of the Union address Wednesday night, President Bush accused Syria of harboring terrorists and charging that Iran's the world's primary sponsor of terror. This as he hailed the recent elections in Iraq, Afghanistan, Ukraine, and the Palestinian territories. On Iraq, the president rejected calls for a timetable of withdrawal of the 150,000 U.S. troops stationed there. On the domestic front, President Bush called for the privatization of Social Security, the renewed use of nuclear energy, a war on gangs, a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, and legal reforms to protect corporations from being sued for negligence. Today, Bush is beginning a five-state tour to advocate for the privatization of Social Security. Under his plan, beginning in 2009, workers age 55 or younger could begin investing a third of their payroll tax in Wall Street investment accounts. Also during the State of the Union, Bush called on Congress to give Palestinians $350 million in new aid and said a Palestinian state is, quote, within reach. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas have announced they will meet next Tuesday in their first summit since the death of Yasser Arafat. Abbas is expected to announce a formal ceasefire. On Capitol Hill, the Senate is continuing debate over the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez for Attorney General. Democratic Senator Richard Durbin said, quote, "I cannot in good conscience vote to reward a man who ignored the rule of law and the demands of human decency and created the permissive environment that made Abu Ghraib possible." In news from Iraq, at least 20 people have died in the most violent day since Sunday's election. The deadliest incident occurred in the northern city of Kirkuk, where 12 Iraqi army recruits were killed following an ambush by Iraqi militants. In Bakuba, gunmen shot and killed two people driving in a vehicle that carried Iraqi contractors. In Mosul, a mortar attack on a U.S. base killed two civilians and injured six. In the town of Khaim near the Syrian border, a car bomb exploded at a house used by U.S. military snipers. In the city of Samawa, gunmen overran a police station and killed one police officer. Near Ramadi, the governor of Anbar province narrowly escaped an assassination attempt. And two Marines were killed in fighting in the Anbar province, which includes the city of Fallujah. In other news from Iraq, the influential Sunni group, the Association of Muslim Scholars, has officially called Sunday's vote illegitimate. A spokesperson said, quote, "We cannot participate in the drafting of a constitution written under military occupation." In military news, the Marine Corps missed their monthly recruiting goal in January, marking the first time this has happened in nearly a decade. The Marines have suffered 31% of the military deaths in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Marines are also making headlines in San Diego after a high-ranking Marine general admitted at a public discussion that it is, quote, "fun to shoot some people." Lieutenant General James Mattis, who fought in Iraq, went on to say, quote, "It's a lot of fun to fight. You know, it's a hell of a hoot. I like brawling." Mattis leads Camp Pendleton's 1st Marine Division in Iraq. In London, the Daily Mail's reporting the British military plans to charge 7 of its own soldiers with murder for killing an Iraqi civilian 2 years ago. President Bush has promoted Elliot Abrams to be his deputy national security advisor. He'll be responsible for pushing Bush's strategy for advancing democracy abroad. Abrams played a key role in the Iran-Contra scandal and pled guilty in 1991 to withholding information from Congress. On October 10, 1986, Abrams, then a State Department employee, testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that he did not know that Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was directing illegal arms sales to Iran and diverting the proceeds to assist the Nicaraguan Contras. Republican Congressmember Joel Heffley, who had admonished House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, has been replaced as chair of the House Ethics Committee and removed from the committee. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said his ouster is, quote, further evidence that there is a purge underway of any Republican who does not precisely toe the party line. In business news, General Electric has become the second major company to announce it will stop doing new business in Iran. Halliburton made a similar announcement last week. A GE spokesperson said the decision was made, quote, because of uncertain conditions relating to Iran. In recent weeks, speculation has grown the U.S. or Israel may carry out an attack on Iran to cripple its alleged nuclear weapons program. For years, Halliburton and GE have skirted a trade embargo on Iran by setting up foreign-owned subsidiaries to deal directly with Iran. In Nepal, the nation's king, who seized complete control of the country on Sunday, has banned journalists from publishing or broadcasting any report critical of the government for the next 6 months. Most other basic rights have also been suspended, including freedom of assembly, the right to privacy, and the right against preventative detention. Members of the Nepalese government who were deposed earlier this week are now under house arrest. Meanwhile, the anti-government Maoist rebels have called for a 3-day general strike. The prime minister of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia has been found dead in an apartment after being poisoned by carbon monoxide that apparently leaked from a faulty heater. In news from Haiti, the interim U.S.-backed government has announced plans to hold a series of local and national elections beginning next October. They'll mark the first election since Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was overthrown 11 months ago in a coup backed by the United States. Aristide's party, Lavalas, has announced they will only participate in the elections if the interim government stops jailing and killing supporters of Aristide. Hundreds of Aristide supporters are now in prison. More than 250 have been killed by violence in pro-Aristide neighborhoods over the past 6 months. And finally, in Independence, Missouri, a jury ruled Wednesday that tobacco giant Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation must pay $22 million to the family of a 73-year-old woman who died of lung and heart disease after smoking Kools for 58 years. The jury award is the fifth largest in the nation for an individual smoker against a tobacco company. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. Well, our first story is the State of the Union address. President Bush delivered that address, the first of his second term, Wednesday, and in it he called for a major restructuring of Social Security, and he pressed as the major theme of his foreign policy the continued spread of democracy. On the domestic front, Bush also called for the renewed use of nuclear energy, a war on gangs, a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, and legal reforms to protect corporations from being sued for negligence.
But it was Social Security that formed the centerpiece of the president's address. Bush warned Social Security is, quote, headed toward bankruptcy, offered a few more details on his plan to partially privatize the system. The speech kicked off a five-state campaign tour to advocate the restructuring plan, in which Bush faces nearly unanimous opposition from congressional Democrats. Later in the program, we're going to host a debate on Social Security between Paul Krugman of the New York Times and Eric Engen of the American Enterprise Institute. But first, we're going to take a look at foreign policy aspects of the Bush address. He used his speech to reinforce his inauguration theme of spreading democracy around the world.
The United States has no right, no desire, and no intention to impose our form of government on anyone else. That is one of the main differences between us and our enemies. They seek to impose and expand an empire of oppression in which a tiny group of brutal, self-appointed rulers control every aspect of every life. Our aim is to build and preserve a community of free and independent nations with governments that answer to their citizens and reflect their own cultures. And because democracies respect their own people and their neighbors, the advance of freedom will lead to peace.
In this address, the president devoted a large portion of his comments to foreign policy in Iraq. He rejected calls for a timetable for withdrawal of 150,000 U.S. troops stationed there and celebrated the Iraqi elections that took place on Sunday. In one of the more dramatic moments, Bush noted the presence of an Iraqi voter in the chamber.
One of Iraq's leading democracy and human rights advocates is Safia Taleb al-Suhail. She says of her country, "We were occupied for 35 years by Saddam Hussein. That was the real occupation. Thank you to the American people who paid the cost, but most of all, to the soldiers." 11 years ago, Safia's father was assassinated by Saddam's intelligence service. 3 days ago in Baghdad, Safia was finally able to vote for the leaders of her country, and we are honored that she is with us tonight.
President Bush in his State of the Union address last night. We turn now to Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thanks, Amy. Good to be with you both.
Well, we're going to focus with you on foreign policy. Later, we'll talk about Social Security. What did you make of President Bush's address?
Well, foreign policy was clearly not the major substantive part of his address. He used all of his very popular inauguration rhetoric of freedom and liberty. The word count this time, freedom 20 times, liberty 7 times, a few down from the use of those same words during his inauguration speech, but still way up there. The Iraqi election, as you've indicated, was used very much as a symbol to gain applause, to gain evidence that U.S. policy in Iraq is working. There was, as Juan mentioned, there was no plan, in fact, an explicit rejection of any plan for withdrawal of the troops or even setting a timetable for withdrawal. No acknowledgement that the presence of the U.S. troops, the U.S. occupation itself, is the problem in Iraq rather than the solution. No mention of the U.S. bases, the 14 permanent bases that are being built, no mention of the continuing U.S. control in Iraq that continues after the elections and will continue throughout the creation of an Iraqi parliament and assembly, those things including the transitional laws imposed by Paul Bremer, which are still in place, the control of the huge amounts, billions of dollars of money that U.S. forces control and will be used as essentially a slush fund for that assembly. So there was very little detail in the discussion of Iraq. On the question of the broader sort of regional plan, the expansion of liberty throughout the Middle East region, there was nothing. There was no detail. There was a quiet request to key U.S. allies, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, that they might want to use this as a moment to increase their democratic tendencies. Major threats to Syria and Iran as ostensibly the supporters of terrorism in the region. The only details, however, had to do with the Israel-Palestine issue, and there was very little detail there as well. The only specific was the mention of a Bush administration request to Congress for $350 million to assist the Palestinians in their security and political development towards creating a democratic state. What we learned today is that at least $80 million of that, perhaps more, will actually go to Israel to pay for high-security gates in the apartheid wall that is chewing up huge components of the West Bank and the wall that will surround Gaza.
Phyllis, let's go for a moment to the portion of the speech where President Bush referred to Israel and the Palestinian territories.
The goal of two democratic states, Israel and Palestine living side by side in peace, is within reach, and America will help them achieve that goal.
Phyllis Bennis.
Again, no detail about the real issue here, which is the Israeli occupation. The word occupation, of course, never existed in the speech. There was nothing even about Israeli responsibilities that they agreed to under the so-called roadmap under U.S. sponsorship, in which Israel agreed to freeze settlements, to dismantle all settlements established after the year 2000. Nothing of that. None of those things, of course, have been accomplished, and there was no mention of those obligations in Bush's speech. We should also note here, Amy, I think it's very important what was missing from the speech. There was no mention of Africa. There was no mention of the global crises, including AIDS, including development issues. There was not even a mention of the tsunami victims and what remains in the crisis in South Asia following the tsunami. What we got instead was a great deal of new rhetoric, some of the same words, freedom and liberty. We heard this time about advances of freedom, landmarks and liberty. We also heard about the empire of oppression as the new replacement, apparently, for the axis of evil. So we're hearing a new level of rhetoric. What was very disturbing, I found, in looking at the two parts of the speech was that in the domestic section of the speech, there were many moments when almost all the Democrats, and indeed some Republicans, actually sat out the massive applause waves at various points. But when it came to the foreign policy side, the Democrats were on their feet in standing ovations throughout the speech, almost indistinguishable from the Republicans. That was a very depressing recognition.
Phyllis, also in terms of what you're mentioning of the things that he left out, clearly, as you said, not only Africa was not talked about, and of course Latin America, which still remains the main source of profit and income for American corporations around the world, which has been undergoing an enormous transformation politically over the last few years, and many of the nations rejecting the neoliberal approach of the U.S. government. Not a single mention of that. Not a mention of China in the issue of democracy and of democratization and human rights and China playing such a major role in the world, what U.S. policy will be toward China in the future as well.
Absolutely. There were many, many things missing here. It was clear that substance was not the goal of the foreign policy section of this speech. This was about rhetoric. This was about gaining popular support. This was setting the stage for Bush's new campaign effort on Social Security, where he wants to have at his back a broad level of support for the goal of freedom and independence that he can kind of point to and say, we're doing that abroad, now at home, here's the work we have to do. I think that it was aimed at avoiding any issues that would require serious changes in U.S. policy, for example, towards Africa, for example, towards the newly democratic countries where there is, as you say, Juan, real democracy brewing in Latin America, where we may have to reevaluate policies towards China, towards Russia, towards the United Nations. None of these were on the agenda. There was no attempt to use this speech to actually outline new political goals in the foreign policy arena. it was more of the same, shaped by a new level of rhetoric and announced in the context of the new announcement that Elliot Abrams is going to emerge as the old criminal of Iran-Contra days, is now going to be the deputy national security advisor in the Bush administration, one of the highest-ranking positions around. So his rehabilitation after years of being dismissed as a criminal for lying to Congress represents, in a sense, the punctuation mark to the foreign policy section of the speech last night.
Interesting that he was involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. And when we come back from our break, Phyllis Bennis, we want to ask you about Iran and Syria. Stay with us. Thousand and One Dreams, Euphoria, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
To promote peace in the broader Middle East, we must confront regimes that continue to harbor terrorists and pursue weapons of mass murder. Syria still allows its territory and parts of Lebanon to be used by terrorists who seek to destroy every chance of peace in the region. You have passed, and we are applying, the Syrian Accountability Act, and we expect the Syrian government to end all support for terror and open the door to freedom. Today, Iran remains the world's primary state sponsor of terror, pursuing nuclear weapons while depriving its people of the freedom they seek and deserve. We are working with European allies to make clear to the Iranian regime that it must give up its uranium enrichment program and any plutonium reprocessing and end its support for terror. And to the Iranian people, I say tonight, as you stand for your own liberty, America stands with you.
President Bush in his inauguration address on Wednesday night. Phyllis Bennis, finally, on Iran and Syria, the warnings.
Well, the warnings were relatively muted in this speech. The Syrian Accountability Act was referred to. There was the broad question, we expect the Syrian government to end all support for terror, open the door to freedom. Of course, Bush is not so eager to push for democratization in Syria, not least because a large proportion of the democratic activists in Syria are Islamists who would not be much in favor with the Bush agenda. So it was left a little bit vague. It was sort of a rhetorical attack on Syria, mainly the problem being that the throwing open of the Iraqi borders at the time of the U.S. invasion led to a wide range of traffic back and forth between Syria and Iraq, something that the U.S. occupation was clearly responsible for. But this is not something that was referred to specifically, and there were no further direct threats against Syria. On the question of Iran, identifying Iran first as the world's primary state sponsor of terror, the main part of Bush's response to that was to reassert the goal of the U.S. in working with European allies, who are, of course, seeking a diplomatic rather than military solution to Iran's alleged efforts to create nuclear weapons. But he did add in this line as a statement supposedly to the Iranian people, as you stand for your own liberty, America stands with you. Now, this raises, of course, the real question of regime change. And with the information that has recently come out from Cy Hirsch and others about efforts that the U.S. has already undertaken in Iran, that there are already special operations forces, perhaps of American troops, perhaps of American-supported puppet troops in acting on their behalf inside Iran, doing the kind of investigation, the kind of covert operations that would prepare for an attack on either alleged Iranian nuclear facilities, either by the United States or Israel, or perhaps a larger ground or air attack on Iran. This cannot be taken lightly. The fact that he added in, that Bush added in his speech, this very direct statement to the Iranian the Iranian people, as you stand for your own liberty, we stand with you. That's a rather direct threat to Iran, that regime change remains an option for the U.S. despite the current willingness to let the Europeans take the lead in a negotiated solution with Iran.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you very much for being with us of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
Well, we turn now to the domestic portion of the president's State of the Union address. He devoted a large portion of that to his push to restructure Social Security. The address kicked off a five-state campaign-style tour to advocate the privatization of the system. The plan faces nearly unanimous opposition from congressional Democrats, few of whom stood up or applauded during the Social Security portion of the speech. In his address, the president argued that the retirement system was headed toward bankruptcy.
For younger workers, the Social Security system has serious problems that will grow worse with time. Social Security was created decades ago for a very different era. In those days, people did not live as long. Benefits were much lower than they are today. And a half century ago, about 16 workers paid into the system for each person drawing benefits. Our society has changed in ways the founders of Social Security could not have foreseen. In today's world, people are living longer and therefore drawing benefits longer. And those benefits are scheduled to rise dramatically over the next few decades. And instead of 16 workers paying in for every beneficiary, right now it's only about 3 workers. And over the next few decades, that number will fall to just 2 workers per beneficiary. With each passing year, fewer workers are paying ever higher benefits to an ever larger number of retirees. So here's the result. 13 years from now, in 2018, Social Security will be paying out more than it takes in. And every year afterward will bring a new shortfall, bigger than the year before. For example, in the year 2027, the government will somehow have to come up with an extra $200 billion to keep the system afloat. And by 2033, the annual shortfall would be more than $300 billion. By the year 2042, the entire system would be exhausted and bankrupt. If steps are not taken to avert that outcome, the only solutions would be dramatically higher taxes, massive new borrowing, or sudden and severe cuts in Social Security benefits or other government programs.
President Bush in his inaugural address on Wednesday night. We're joined on the telephone by Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, professor of economics at Princeton University. His latest book is a textbook, a college textbook called Microeconomics. Also wrote The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. And we're joined by Eric Engen, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Paul Krugman, let's begin with you. Your response to President Bush's saying that Social Security is going bankrupt.
Well, you heard the booing, and that was well justified. I mean, even if you believe those fairly pessimistic estimates, in the year that the trust fund is exhausted, which is what he's referring to, Social Security will be taking in about 75 cents for every dollar of expenses. If that's bankrupt, then the U.S. federal government is bankrupt right today. If you look at the federal government outside Social Security, right now it's taking in only 68 cents. of revenue per dollar of expenses. So, I mean, this is a wild exaggeration to call it bankrupt. But I think the really important thing is that nothing in what the president said last night would do anything to address that issue. The most interesting stuff that we heard was actually not in the speech, but what a senior administration official told reporters in a background briefing. We got a little bit more of the, you know, a little bit more, another step in the striptease about what the Bush plan would actually involve. And it's pretty clear that it involves nothing. You know, we'll go into this, I'm sure, in the course of the discussion. But there's nothing in there that would do anything to help the finances of Social Security. So, you know, the complete disconnect between what he's warning about and what he wants to do.
Eric Engen, your response on this whole issue of is it appropriate to call this a possible bankruptcy of the Social Security system?
Well, I think, you know, if when you start talking about bankrupt, you get into semantics and what one person means by bankrupt and another. I think the main issue is what is the state of the system. And I think there the president described it correctly. He basically just reiterated what's in the annual Social Security trustees report, and that is in 2018, the outflow of benefit payments starts to exceed taxes. The system would then have to start counting on the funds that are in the trust fund, and ultimately it's 2042. Now, these numbers, you know, vary from year to year to a certain extent, but generally that's the state of the system. Now, the issue is that in 2018, although the trust fund provides budget authority for Social Security, what would have to happen at that point is for the general budget in order to make those payments is that in the general part of the government's budget, they would have to either raise taxes or reduce spending or borrow from the public in order to meet those payments. As the Congressional Budget Office has said, the trust fund represents budget authority for Social Security, but it doesn't represent real economic resources. So this issue of whether we should or should not reform Social Security is one that's interesting because back in the Clinton administration, their Social Security Advisory Council, headed by Ned Gramlich, who's currently at the Federal Reserve Board, they came to the conclusion that, look, the system ultimately needs to be reformed and it's better to do it early rather than later. Much of the latter part of the Clinton administration, they were weighing these topics of reforming Social Security. Many economists have noted that the demographic pressures of the retirement of the baby boom will put the Social Security system ultimately on a path that's not sustainable, and that it's better and more responsible to start working towards reform early when changes can be gradual rather than waiting right at the point where the system has to face either 25% benefit cuts in that year or increases in taxes.
Paul Krugman, your response.
Yeah, I think you know, this has become the final, the last defense as the other arguments fall apart, which is, oh, Clinton wanted it too. And there's an enormous difference between what the situation that was envisaged in the later years of the Clinton administration and where we are now. The situation we thought we had, was Social Security was building up a trust fund, and it was entirely real because it was being used to help the federal government as a whole pay down debt. And so that was, you couldn't say that the surplus wasn't actually contributing to the future ability to pay bills. You were actually paying down debt, and that was helping. But because we were running an overall budget surplus, it looked likely, people actually believed 5 years ago, that we were going to run out of debt to pay down. And so during the Clinton years, people talked about, well, what else can Social Security invest in? And how should we organize that investment? And there were various discussions about how it should be handled, whether it should simply be considered part of the trust fund, whether we should have some other system of accounting. None of that applies now. The situation right now is that we have Social Security itself is being run on a relatively responsible basis. The Social Security system is running a surplus now. I mean, if you say, you know, all the stuff about 16 workers per retiree, well, you know, we have 3 workers per retiree now, and we're running a surplus, so that we will have an eventual transition to 2. And so Social Security itself has mild long-run financial shortfall, maybe. But the big problem is the rest of the federal government is running an enormous deficit, that we've blown the surplus that we had in at the end of the 90s. And that is the problem. The issue is not, oh, how are we going to deal with the fact that Social Security is going to actually start wanting to collect some interest on its bonds in 2018 or 2020, says the CBO, but it's the fact that we've plunged the rest of the federal government into deep deficit. And that, not Social Security, is the reason to be worried about the budget picture.
I'd like to ask both of you. Back in the early 80s, Senator Moynihan worked with Republicans for some reforms of Social Security at that time that ended up creating the enormous surpluses that still exist today. Bush's assessment of this assume that nothing happens between now and 2018 or 2042, then this scenario will occur. But if some reforms, for instance, increases in Social Security taxes or some minor reforms were begun now, wouldn't that have an effect on this doomsday scenario of 2042? I'd like to begin first with Eric Engen.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that in the sense that is the main point right now. It was the main point of the Clinton administration's discussion about Social Security, of Alan Greenspan's long discussion of it ever since he was the head of the Reform Commission back in 1983. And the current discussion is that the system needs a change to be long-term sustainable. Okay, that's what the best estimates change. And certainly, if any change is made, whether it's on the benefit or the tax side, whether it's reducing the projected growth in benefits or raising tax, that's going to then change the outlook.
Yeah, but, can I just weigh in?
But first, I'd like to clarify with Mr. Engen. When you say some changes will be made, what I was referring to was reforms in the existing system. Isn't the president's proposal really a revamping and a philosophical change in the actual system?
Not completely. I mean, certainly it's being portrayed at times as complete privatization of Social Security. Well, that's not true. I mean, what it is is first of all, I mean, he said in terms of current retirees and those near retirement, it wouldn't change at all. The second thing is that people would have the choice of either staying in just the traditional system or voluntarily, if they wanted to, add a personal account to the system. Okay, these accounts would not be large. I mean, we're talking about 4% of wages up to $1,000. So still the bulk of the payroll tax that people pay would go towards the traditional system. So you would have the people that, say, did not opt into personal accounts, they would still be in the traditional part of the system. Those that did would still have a Social Security benefit that would come from the traditional part of the system, plus the personal account.
Paul Krugman, what's wrong with that?
Well, let's just talk about what it would take to maintain the system as essentially as it is, with no major changes. Congressional Budget Office numbers, which I think are the most plausible, say that for another 75 years to secure it as is, we would need about 0.4% of GDP, which turns out to be the equivalent of about $45 billion per year at this right now. So that's about a tenth of our current budget deficit. It's about one-fifth of the revenue sacrificed because of the Bush tax cuts. So just bear in mind, this is securing Social Security on a financial basis is a really fairly small problem. It's not something that would require a massive overhaul. Now, the thing about, again, we still don't have any specifics about how the traditional plans will be affected under the Bush, whatever the plan is. But for what we have looked at, Plan 2 from the Bush Commission on Social Security a few years ago, which still looks like we're a guess about what it might look like. It creeps up on you. But if you look half a century ahead, the replacement rate, the fraction of people's income during their earning lifetimes that gets replaced by Social Security benefits after retirement would be cut in half from what it is now. So you may say, oh, well, it's just a bit, you know, first of all, if you hit 4% of payroll, that's a third of the Social Security tax. And if we look at plausible descriptions of what the eventual plan might look like, it looks like essentially you're going to get rid of half of the system in the long run. So if you want to say this is just a small thing, it's not. This is a fundamental revamping of the system. And above all, I think that we just need to keep coming back to the point that as far as we can tell, the private accounts business has nothing whatsoever to do with closing the financial shortfall of Social Security. It's just you're going to create an atmosphere of crisis about this long-term shortfall in the aging population, and then the key part of the plan has nothing to do with that. It's just about something else. It's about transforming the system, and then there's going to be something else slipped in through the back door maybe to deal with the financial thing. But this is it's a complete bait and switch. In terms of the policy.
We're talking to Paul Krugman of the New York Times, has a new college textbook out called Microeconomics, and we're joined by Eric Engen of the American Enterprise Institute. We're going to break, and then we'll be right back and find out who actually profits from the changing of Social Security. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
To bring the trauma overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate, and when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate, and that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all, y'all.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach? And would you turn the other cheek? Father, Father,
Black Eyed Peas, Where is the Love? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica radio stations and NPR, public access TV, as well as PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org, where you can sign up for our daily headlines. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Eric Engen of the American Enterprise Institute and Paul Krugman, columnist for the New York Times, professor of economics at Princeton University. The question of who profits. Paul Krugman, what exactly happens and who pays for this?
We don't know what exactly happens. In spite of all of this, we still don't know. But it looks as if, I mean, the description right now is that it's going to have very little to do with actually investing your own money. That what's actually going to happen is that the Social Security Administration is going to invest on your behalf in a mixture of stocks and bonds, and sort of end of story. The big question that everyone wants to know is really how are these accounts, if they exist, going to be managed? And we didn't hear anything about that except that. Mr. Bush did insist that it was going to be run like the thrift savings plan, which is for federal employees, which is something in which there really is it's basically just the government managing your money. I basically don't believe that. I mean, I basically believe that they might start it that way, but that within a very short time there would be strong pressure to open this up so that investment mutual funds could compete for people's business, in which case there's a lot of money from mutual funds involved. But so far, we have no information on what will actually happen.
Eric Engen, your sense of that? Because I remember the Wall Street Journal, a front-page article a couple of days after the election, which was attempting to say which industries are expecting to benefit from the second Bush term, and high among them were the Wall Street brokerage houses and mutual funds that expected to be able to make large amounts of money on the privatization aspect of the president's plan.
Well, I think that it's clear that the administration would model personal accounts along the lines of the Thrift Saving Plan, which is a 401k type of plan for federal employees, as Professor Krugman said. That's a system that's been in place now since the early 80s, so we have about 20 years of experience in that. It is run at a very low cost in terms of administrative costs. They're way, way, way below any of the average rates of costs to the investors as compared to mutual funds. And that would be the type of model clearly for a personal account component of Social Security. It would not be government investment in the sense that people would have a limited number of options. When the Thrift Saving Plan was first opened, there were three options, a stock index fund, a corporate bond index fund, and a treasury fund. That has since been expanded by two additional funds, one an international stock fund and another a small cap fund. These are all index funds, so they're not like internet or gold funds or anything such as that. They're broadly diversified. And one thing that they're adding that would also be in this is what's called life cycle funds, which are a mix of stocks and bonds that would change over the person's lifetime, so that they would initially, when younger, be more invested in stocks relative to bonds, but then that mix would change to a more conservative portfolio as they went forward.
Can I
yes, Paul Kirk.
Investment industry has explicitly said that the head of, for example, the Securities Industry Association has said they don't view this as a big windfall because the government would make the financial providers bid on these at low cost. So essentially, it would not be a big profit center, just as the investment providers for the Thrift Saving Plan are not reaping huge profits from that plan.
I want to interrupt for a second to bring in Harry Reid, the Senate Minority Leader, who responded to the inauguration address right afterwards.
Let me share with you why I believe the president's plan is so dangerous. There's a lot we can do to improve America's retirement security, but it's wrong to replace the guaranteed benefit that Americans have earned with a guaranteed benefit cut of up to 40%. Make no mistake, that's exactly what President Bush is proposing. The Bush plan would take our already record high $4.3 trillion debt and put us another $2 trillion in the red. That's an immoral burden to place on the backs of the next generation. But maybe most of all, the Bush plan isn't really Social Security reform. It's more like Social Security roulette. Democrats are all for giving Americans more of a say and more choices when it comes to their retirement savings, but that doesn't mean taking Social Security's guarantee and gambling with it. And that's coming from a senator who represents Las Vegas.
Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid responding to the inaugural address. Paul Krugman, what about this $1 to $2 trillion they're talking about? What is this cost for?
No, it's actually much more than that. We're actually talking about, I mean, what's happening here is that payroll tax revenue is being diverted into these private accounts. And because that's revenue that's no longer there, it's the federal government's going to have to borrow to make up the difference. And what looks like, as best we can make out, is it's a $1 trillion in the first decade, another $3.5 trillion in the second decade, and continuing onwards. And again, I don't think anyone's plotted out this one directly, but the plans we've all looked at suggest that the budget deficit will be higher than it otherwise would be until about 2050.
And then maybe there would be some positive stuff. But we're really talking about borrowing trillions and trillions of dollars to replace the money that's being diverted into private accounts. And the only way this comes out as a possible benefit is if those private accounts do sufficiently well on the stocks that make up part of the investment to offset the borrowing cost. So if you distill the whole thing down to its essence, it's the U.S. government borrowing to buy stocks. But shifting the risk, and this is the really important thing, shifting the risk onto retirees. It's not it would be bad enough if the federal government were just going to borrow to buy stocks as a way of doing something. But what it's actually doing is it's borrowing on your behalf, you the retiree, telling you, well, you know, you might want to put some of this in stocks, and then saying, well, if it does badly, well, that's your problem.
Your response, Eric Engen.
Well, I think first, I mean, what the transition costs, as they're called, represent is a movement of what is currently unfunded liability that is of Social Security that is not on the government's books onto the government's books. If the government took account of not just Social Security, but its entire budget the way a private corporation would in terms of having the unfunded liabilities actually on their books, there would be no extra cost to it. It's just moving it from a what is now an unfunded liability to an explicit liability. Now, it would make that debt explicit. But to match it, there would be an equal amount in the private accounts. So in terms of its overall effect, it would be a wash in that sense. I think the bottom line here, and I think the most important thing that came out of Senator Reid's comments was a criticism of the Bush proposal to reform Social Security. Okay, that's fine. That's part of the debate, but we still haven't heard any alternatives from the Democratic side to put on the table.
Paul Krugman, let's get those alternatives.
It needs to be reformed.
Let me just come back. Here we have a plan that does nothing to address the short term. To address the financial shortfall, right? We've got a system that probably has a financial shortfall. It's not very large. Here we have a plan that does nothing to address that, but that adds a lot of risk. And then the complaint is, well, what's the Democrats' alternative? That doesn't seem to me to be a fair test to impose. I mean, you know, I think the natural alternative is, well, you know, let's find some ways to save a little bit of money and put a little bit of money in. But, you know, we aren't hearing any of that from the president. So why is that up to the Democrats?
Plan two of the commission report, it is a full plan that does achieve solvency by Social Security Administration.
If the administration wants to really go with Plan 2 and have an actual discussion of Plan 2, I think the Democrats would be delighted.
I think it will move further along. I mean, as far as a State of the Union address, this probably provided more details on any particular proposal than I think any president had. Usually a State of the Union is not where all the full details of anything are put out. He did lay on the table a number of potential options that he said are there in terms of restraining benefit growth.
I want to interrupt for a second because I know Paul Krugman has to leave. But a very quick question. In addition to Social Security, Bush called for making his tax cuts permanent, further deregulation, tax reform, cutting the deficit in half by 2009. Your quick response.
And manna from heaven and free lunches for everyone. There's no way you can make the tax cuts permanent and also do that, do a major reduction in the deficit. So this is, you know, he's demanding, it's like the mythical story of the legislators who demanded that all wheels have circumference that's three times their diameter. Sorry, the arithmetic doesn't work. Sorry, it's amazing stuff. Basically, a belief that he can say a lot of stuff that just doesn't add up, and they won't be called on it.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Paul Krugman of the New York Times, Eric Engen of the American Enterprise Institute. As we end today, not on the inaugural address, but on the confirmation hearings of Michael Chertoff. Yesterday, the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held these hearings on Michael Chertoff, President Bush's nominee to head the Department of Homeland Security.
Chertoff is a federal judge who worked under John Ashcroft in the Justice Department after September 11th. He led the government's move to jail hundreds of Muslim and Arab men without pressing charges. He was also a chief architect of the USA Patriot Act. Chertoff is expected to be easily confirmed when the committee votes on Monday.
Yesterday's hearing was overshadowed by the continuing Senate confirmation hearings of Alberto Gonzalez as attorney general. While most members praised Chertoff at the hearing, Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan questioned Chertoff's role in the infamous August 2002 so-called torture memo. That Justice Department memo provided a very narrow definition of torture, arguing only physical abuse, quote, of an intensity akin to that which accompanies serious physical injury, such as death or organ failure, amounted to torture. This is Senator Carl Levin.
All right. Now, do you agree with the definition of torture contained in the August 1, 2002 memo?
Let me begin by saying, first of all, of course, torture is illegal. So we begin with that proposition. And in fact, the president has said that on a number of occasions. Since I saw a draft of what I believe became this memo, I don't remember if that language was in it or if it was in it, whether it was used as or purported to be kind of a bottom line definition.
My question is, do you agree, not did you?
So
I'll get
to that in a moment. I do not believe that definition is a sufficiently comprehensive definition of torture.
All right, now let's go back in time. Did you object to the definition in the memo in 2002?
As I say, because I don't remember the way it was specifically worded, I can tell you that my role in dealing with the memo was limited to this. I was asked to communicate what my views were as a kind of practical prosecutor about how a statute like the torture statute would be applied. And my essential position, and again, this is talking to other lawyers, so it's really lawyer-to-lawyer kind of discussion, was that when you're dealing with a statute with a general standard and an intent issue, the question of good faith and an honest and reasonable assessment of what you're doing becomes critical. And whether or not a particular type of thing that someone proposes to do violates the statute is going to depend, or whether a prosecutor views it as a violation of the statute, is going to depend a great deal upon whether the particular technique is specifically mentioned in the statute, or if it's not, whether the people who are thinking about doing it are making an honest assessment about whether what they're going to do rises to the level of the statute. I guess my bottom line advice was this. You are dealing in an area where there's potential criminal liability. You had better be very careful to make sure that whatever it is you decide to do falls well within what is required by the law.
Department of Homeland Security confirmation nominee to be secretary is Michael Chertoff. He was being questioned by Carl Levin, Democratic Senator of Michigan. This is Democracy Now!, and that wraps up our program. I look forward to seeing people in Sarasota on Friday night at Sarasota News and Books at 5:30 in the afternoon, along with George McGovern. And then they're going to be showing the film A Bright Shining Moment about George McGovern in the evening at the Sarasota Film Festival at the Regal Theater, and we look forward to seeing people there on Saturday morning at the Fogartyville Cafe at 10 o'clock in Bradenton, Florida. Look forward to celebrating independent media and low-power FM station in the area. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. If you want to sign up for our daily headlines, go to our website at democracynow.org. And we've broken our G4 screen. We're looking for a new one, if anyone can help us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.